the wind, the sun, or the rain. We can be like they are. Come on, baby, don't feel the rainbow. Baby, take my hand. Don't feel the rainbow. We'll be able to fly. Don't feel the rainbow. Baby, I'm the
Live from the City of Angels, this is Coast to Coast AM with George Norrie.
Tonight, a very special three-hour discussion about the history of the occult with our guest, Mitch Horowitz. We'll be back with Mitch in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. His name is Mitch Horowitz. He's the editor, writer of many years of experience with a lifelong interest in man's search for meaning. He's the executive editor of the metaphysical publisher Tarcher Penguin in New York and a frequent contributor to magazines including Science of Mind, Venture Inward, Atlantis Rising, and Lapis. And he's one of the leading publishers and writers on occult and esoteric themes. He's our special guest tonight on Coast to Coast. Mitch, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. Very glad to be here.
First time guest, too.
Yes, sir.
I enjoyed that. You know, when I hear the word occult, and so many other people as well, to them, to us, it sounds scary. Is that accurate or is it not?
I don't think it's accurate at all. We have been trained to be frightened of that word, and I think the reasons for that go back many, many centuries. But the fact is, people who get involved with the practices that we call occult, which might be divination, such as palm reading or astrology or tarot card reading, in general, their experiences are extremely positive. They cultivate a lot of intuition. They learn a lot about themselves and about the world around them. But you have to participate to realize all that.
Well, when people dabble in the occult, what are they really trying to do?
I think they're trying to learn about themselves. I think we have a hunger for self-knowledge, and we pursue that in different ways. Some people pursue it through therapy. Some people pursue it through the mainstream religions. Some people pursue it through the study of philosophy. And some people want to look to crafts that come out of folklore, that come out of the ancient traditions, that come out of the hearts of the traditional religious faiths, that really help us understand something about ourselves and the natural world. It's all about the pursuit of self-knowledge. The ancients believed in an expression that goes something like, as above, so below. They believed that the natural world reflected man's inner state. So if you could learn something, for example, about the configuration of the cosmos at the time of your birth, you could learn something about your innermost state.
Did mainstream religion, were they the ones that really started getting people to back away from this word occult?
Absolutely. In fact, the word pagan, which we take to mean a pre-Christian believer in a pantheon of gods, the word pagan was originally a derogatory term from early Latin that meant something like a country bumpkin. When Christianity began to rise to a place of prominence in the Roman Empire, the news tended to travel slowly to the more outer-lying villages and hamlets. And people in the more rural parts of the empire still tended to practice the old ways, that is to say, the nature-based religions. And these people were called pagans or villagers. And the church authorities at that time were in a tremendous struggle for the hearts and minds of the populace. And they began to associate the old earth-based religions with something called Satanism, which had never existed for the worshipers of the pre-Christian gods. This was, to a very great extent, an invention of the early church. It was an attempt to associate the old nature-based religions with something sinister. And that continues to this day. Just a few weeks ago, I was in the town of Salem, Massachusetts.
Oh, yes.
Everybody knows Salem, Massachusetts, which was the site of America's own infamous witch trials. Now, it so happens today, Salem is a lovely town with a lot of New Age shops up and down its main street. And there was a mom with her daughter in one of these New Age shops, and the daughter wanted to buy a necklace with the symbol of the pentagram on it, the five-pointed star.
Yes.
And the mom, being completely well-intentioned, said to her daughter, "No, that's an evil symbol, and I'm not going to buy that for you." Now, I wouldn't tell anybody what to bring into their home. I mean, it's a private matter. But the fact is, this pentagram, this five-pointed star, it's a symbol of tremendous power and magnetism. There's a reason, I think, why this young girl was attracted to it. It's intended to be a symbol of natural man. The five points are intended to symbolize our head, our two arms, our two legs. And yet, that symbol, which was really just intended to be a representation of the human form, was associated with something malevolent in the early days of the church, and we've never been able to shake that. However, we've also never been able to shake the symbol, because there is something in that symbol that draws us back to it again and again and again.
Well, it's the same thing, Mitch, with the symbol of the swastika, which is at least 3,000 years old.
Yes, sir.
But nowadays, all of us, when you look at it, it looks evil. You think of Hitler, you think of the Nazis. And,
yes.
And prior to that, prior to Hitler and the Nazi party using it as their emblem or logo, the swastika was just a nice symbol, wasn't it?
Absolutely. It's a symbol of rebirth. It's a symbol of regeneration. Here in my apartment, I have a statue of the Hindu god Ganesh, and he is outstretching his palm, and on his palm is the image of a swastika. This is an ancient image that symbolized rebirth. You find it in ancient Hinduism. You also find similarities to it in certain Native American traditions. It was a symbol of fertility. It was a symbol of regeneration. And the Nazis came along and twisted it into something obscene, and because of that, I think it's been lost to us forever.
I think so, too. I don't think it will ever, anybody will ever be able to turn it around to its old heyday and what it was really meant for.
It's a misfortune.
It's gone.
Yes, it's gone. There's so much tragedy attached to it that I think it's impossible to revive it. But this is what we do with some of these ancient symbols. We take them and we... we attach something to them that they were never associated with throughout centuries, if not millennia.
Well, because one of the things people remember, and you put things, you associate things with what you remember, and unfortunately, the swastika is associated with evil and Hitler and the Nazi party, and that's one of the reasons people won't forget. It's probably one of the reasons, too, why the word the occult has got these feelings of dark, much similar to voodoo, by the way. And I'm going to tell you a story about that in a second. But
yes.
When I hear the word occult, even me, I think of the Black Mass, Satan worshipers, all of which is probably nuts. I think of bad witches, not Wiccans, but you know, evil witches and things like that. And I can't get that out of my mind now. That's what I think of. I think of kids who have gone bad and do evil things. That's what I think of when I hear the word the occult, and I can't get it out of my head.
You know, honestly, I don't think in the Western tradition there even is any such thing as Satanism or Satan worship. I think it is something that was entirely invented by the early institutional church. It had nothing to do with the direct teachings of Christ. I think it was something that was invented as a method of institutional warfare to associate the so-called pagan religions with something malevolent, to scare people, to want to keep people away from those traditions. Now, for example, we associate the idea of horns protruding from a figure's head with Satanism.
The devil, right.
Right. had no such association in antiquity, no such association whatsoever. Horns appeared on the head of ancient gods as symbols of wisdom and enlightenment. In some cases, you will see figures represented with horns coming from their head. In other cases, you will see figures represented with rays of light coming from their head. The association was the same. But the early church, which was engaged in a kind of cultural warfare with the traditions of paganism, tended to associate all these images with some kind of maleficence or evil. I don't think there's any concrete evidence that there has ever been an actual tradition of Satan worship in the West. I do think that in the 19th century, some people got the idea that being Satan worshipers would be a good way to sort of tweak the nose of mainstream religion, and they began to adopt and invent things like the Black Mass, which I don't think really had an authentic history here in the West. Now, we can talk about witchcraft later in our conversation, sure, but there are some people who believe that even witchcraft was more or less an invention of periods of Inquisition when the church was persecuting people.
Yet I believe, and I'm sure you do, that there are some people in society, Western society as well, who practice the Black Mass. I think some of them could be these elitists we hear so much about. They have a very strange, morbid outlook of things, and I think they get together once in a while, Mitch, and they do this stuff.
I agree. You know, there was a terrific showman in the late 60s, early 70s, named Anton LaVey, who ran something called the Church of Satan, which you've probably heard of. And this guy was a bona fide celebrity for many years. And the Church of Satan was supposed to be, the primary place where you could go and practice the Black Mass and where you could go and tap into satanic powers for selfish ends and so on and so forth. I think Anton LaVey, he may have had some sincere ideas. I think the man, to a great extent, was a showman. And if you take a look at his books, which are still in print today, he has a book called The Satanic Bible that you could pick up in almost any large bookstore. A lot of it is, and I just know I'm going to get angry emails for this.
I'm not sure I want to read that book, though. Something will happen to me if I
You'd be surprised how tame it is, actually, once you sit down and read it. A lot of it is warmed over stuff from Aleister Crowley. Some people have identified ideas in it that you'll find within the writings of people like Ayn Rand or people who are into libertarianism. It's really just a fairly mild anti-church manifesto, and it tries to bring a kind of philosophical sophistication to selfishness. But the fact is, he was an impresario, a brilliant impresario, but he was making up a lot of this stuff. I don't think it has deep roots. He and his followers may have been involved in some unsavory things, but I don't think they had roots that extended much deeper than Anton's own life.
You know, you're going to be accused of being a devil's agent. I bet you're going to get emails on that.
I'm sure I am. Well, you know, I would only ask people to go back to the Gospels, look at what Christ's message really was. He was not someone who went around pointing fingers, but he was someone who went around asking people to look into their own hearts. And I think that's what we really need to do in this day and age.
You had mentioned tarot cards and reading of palms and things like that. Is that associated also then with the occult, or is it in its own little arena?
I see it as associated with the occult. I think that tarot, you know, when I talk about the occult, what I really mean is hidden knowledge that requires some kind of direct experience in order to be known. It's very hard for people to appreciate the validity of some of these ideas unless they've participated in them themselves. So tarot cards are a terrific example of this. Tarot cards have been with us more or less since the Middle Ages. There's some controversy about how old they are. Some people will tell you they go back to Egyptian antiquity. I don't think we have any evidence for that, and I've looked very hard. essentially, tarot cards are images that were popular in the Middle Ages. They're images that we will recognize. The figure of death, that is to say the Grim Reaper, the figure of the Pope, the figure of a magician. These are kind of archetypal images that have existed in Western culture for a long, long time. If one gets comfortable with the images of the tarot cards and begins to use them as part of a daily practice, interesting coincidences begin to occur. These images are very powerful. Like the pentagram, they're things that we are drawn to again and again and again. My experience has been that if you use tarot cards in a way that involves putting open-ended questions out there, that involves using them with a wish to understand something about yourself or something about your motivations in a given situation, interesting things occur.
You know, you're right about that. And here's the question. Is it the person who reads the cards that has the ability, or is it the person who's receiving the information that's having this done?
I think it's a mixture of both. I think, first of all, I think people should learn to read tarot cards for themselves. I don't think you need a medium or an intermediary in order to do it. And tarot cards are so widespread and they're so widely available in our society that if somebody's interested in them, I would encourage them to go out, get a good deck of tarot cards, get a couple of good books on the subject, and begin to experiment themselves, because I don't think that you need an intermediary. However, if you do have an intermediary, you can encounter people who have a very good, very strong sense of intuition, who have a good heart, who bring an open heart and a real sense of inquiry to the use of the cards, and they can be of help to you.
I have some friends who practice astrology. I have some friends who are into numerology. They swear this works.
Yes.
I know some psychics. We'll talk later about Edgar Cayce.
Yes.
There are things that are out there in the universe, Mitch, I guess, that work. I can't explain it, but they're there, aren't they?
They are indeed there, and some of these things come to us very, very deep from antiquity. Astrology is something that has been practiced since the dawn of recorded time. Now, one thing that everyone will agree upon is that the ancient civilizations had a tremendous power of observation of the natural world. We marvel at the ability of the Egyptians and the Maya and other cultures to have created calendars that are very close in accuracy to our own, and they knew a lot besides. Their ability to observe the ancient, their ability to observe the natural world and the ways in which its states corresponded to states in man is something that we should not take lightly. We read about the ancient Greeks, for example, consulting the oracle at Delphi. We often skip past that. We celebrate the Greeks for their philosophy, for their agriculture, for their celestial knowledge, for their ability at reasoning. But we skip past these things that don't fit into our contemporary paradigm. Divinatory arts have been with us since the beginning of recorded time, and probably the oldest among them is astrology. Now, what we call astrology today has gotten very watered down, and it's not easy to figure out how much of what we have and we use today can really be attributed to antiquity. It's passed through a lot of filters and a lot of changes, but nonetheless, in my experience, something is there. And I think most people who experiment with astrology and do so carefully, skeptically, with their eyes open, they tend to find something.
Why is there a fascination with the occult? I mean, absolute fascination.
I would say because it contains a piece of the truth. Ideas that tend to endure for a reason. I don't think it's superstition and irrationality. I think, I mean, for heaven's sake, you know, we live in the most rationalistic society in the world, and that's brought us many, many good things. And in this rationalistic society, people continue to be fascinated with some of the ancient arts. I think it is because a critical mass of people have found a piece of the truth in these ideas, and that's why they won't go away. The cynics would tell you it's because people are soft-headed and are given over to believing in nonsense. Well, that's always going to be true of a certain fraction of the population. People believe all kinds of things. But the reason that these ideas have survived is because they contain a spark of truth.
Mitch Horowitz's website, of course, is linked up with his name on coasttocoastam.com, but let me quickly spell it for you in case you're driving around. MitchHorowitz, MitchHorowitz.com. When we come back, we'll chat about Ouija boards, witchcraft, on Coast to Coast AM.
From somewhere out there, this is Coast to Coast AM with George Norrie.
Well, we've had some great stories on the occult in the After Dark newsletter, and upcoming will be a very special report on UFOs. So take advantage, get 14 issues for the price of 12 by calling 1-888-727-5505. That's 1-888-727-5505, or go online at coasttocoastam.com. And welcome back to Coast with our guest, Mitch Horowitz. Mitch, let's talk about witchcraft for a little bit, if we can.
Sure.
There is a difference between witchcraft and Wiccans, or are we talking about the same thing?
Oh, we're primarily talking about the same thing. Some practitioners prefer one term or the other, but essentially it's the same.
I have always been told, and I've interviewed those who practice the Wiccan faith, that these are lovely people. They believe in a male-female god, but they're spiritual. They don't perform evil spells on people or anything like that. Why have people gotten this so confused? These people who are good human beings, why are people categorizing them as such?
In a word, paranoia. I think it's paranoia that goes back to the periods of Inquisition, in which people who may have been suffering from epilepsy or mental disorders were ostracized by their communities, were targeted, were imprisoned, in many cases were killed in really brutal ways that were unfortunately church-sanctioned, such as hanging or burning at the stake. And there's a tremendous amount of tragedy in the history of witchcraft. Obviously, in our own country, we were talking about the Salem witch trials a little bit earlier in our conversation. And I think that there was a fear of outsiders, of the unknown, and these fears in previous generations were stoked by the institutional church or by people who had designs on political power and found it easy to point fingers at somebody and say, that person is behaving in ways that frighten us. We've had a bad corn crop this year. It must be their fault. That's a witch. And these labels stick. In my experience, people who practice Wicca and witchcraft today are some of the loveliest, most gentle, most thoughtful souls I have ever met. It is a fast-growing religion. There are, according to the numbers that I've seen, between 750 and 1 million practitioners of Wicca or witchcraft here in the United States. And in Australia, it is considered the fastest-growing religion. It's a religious tradition that really belongs to our times, because while there are practitioners of Wicca who will claim ancient roots, I think really it is a nature-based religion that draws on some ancient ritual that seeks to reconstruct some of the pagan seasonal traditions, and that has a real consciousness toward ecology and equality between the sexes and things of that nature. It's a contemporary faith, and I think it's a positive one.
Well, I think so, too. It's unfortunate that they've gotten such a bad rap at what they practice and believe in.
Yes. You know, there was a historian who was researching the Salem witch trials, and she came to the conclusion that the young women who were singled out and eventually murdered by the community of Salem may have been suffering from a form of food poisoning that caused dementia. And the community of Salem at that time, this was a very isolated community. It had just passed through a very tough winter. The crops were poor. There was a lot of fear in the air, and it was very easy to go around pointing fingers, and the results were tragic.
Very puritanical, too, were they not?
Oh, very much so. You know, it's the guardians of all that are right and good who are the quickest to point fingers. That has been true from the beginning of history.
Hollywood has done a lot of this, too. I mean, you think of The Witch and The Wizard of Oz.
Yeah.
You know, that's one thing. And then it's everywhere. Even when you're a kid, right, and you read the book, the story Hansel and Gretel.
Yes.
I mean, you think of that witch taking kids, turning them into gingerbread and making
yes.
a house. All that is evil. And I think that contributed to a lot of this.
No question about it, although I think we are starting to see a turnaround. There are positive portrayals of witchcraft on shows like Buffy the Vampire Slayer. There are other shows that are positive representations of witches. So I think that the culture is slowly starting to turn around. There's always going to be a segment of the culture that's going to point fingers and associate witchcraft with evil. But I think on movies and in movies and television, a breakthrough is occurring.
Yet there are some people out there who, and I'm sure you'll agree, there is evil out there on this planet, right?
Indeed there is.
Some people, maybe under the guise of witchcraft, think that they're performing these evil things. I'm sure there are some people out there, Mitch, that are performing evil spells on people to hurt people.
Absolutely. People are good and bad, and we bring that into every practice. I think there are people who are bad-intentioned, who will bring those bad intentions into the occult, into the New Age, and they will try to use these things for selfish ends or to hurt their neighbor. And unfortunately, what they're going to find is that they just isolate themselves, cut themselves off, and hurt themselves. And that's just a fact of human nature. But there is good and bad, and it exists in every facet of our society and within every belief system.
What do you think of the Ouija board?
Well, I possess three Ouija boards, and my wife will not allow me to bring them into the house.
She's a smart woman, Mitch.
Yes, I think she is. I'm often told that. And everything goes on in this house. There is nothing there is nothing off limits in this house, but I am not permitted to bring the Ouija boards in the house. The fact is, most people I have spoken with who have experimented with Ouija boards have had some negative experiences. I don't know why that is. I don't know whether it's a coincidence. I'm sure there are people for whom the opposite is true, but there are a lot of frightening stories out there. It may be that people who are open to suggestion, when you put them together with a Ouija board, for some reason, coincidence goes wrong. And I have heard a lot of frightening stories from people in connection with Ouija boards. I think that everybody who went through a stage, maybe when they were a kid, of playing around with a Ouija board got creeped out at a certain point. And look, I'm not going to make a blanket statement. I think there are probably people who use them and have terrific experiences. But I do know it's the one thing where I've heard of a predominantly negative one.
I think so, too. I mean, I've got a few stories personally and bad experiences with these things. And,
yeah.
And I don't hear, I've heard maybe in 3 years of talking about it on this program, maybe one story where someone said it worked well for them.
You know, the funny thing is, in a sense, the Ouija board should be the most innocent thing in the world. The name Ouija, first of all, is a patented name that belongs to that today belongs to the toy company Parker Brothers.
Right.
It's like Frisbee or Band-Aid or Xerox. The real name for these boards are talking boards or spirit boards. And they came into popularity here in the U.S. in the early 20th century. They became enormously popular as we moved into the teens and the 1920s. In fact, Norman Rockwell himself, the artist of the American Heartland, did a humorous cover on the Saturday Evening Post of a man and a woman playing with a Ouija board. I think there was probably a time in this country's history where I wouldn't be surprised if a substantial fraction of the households in this country has Ouija boards. They've gone down in popularity, but everyone had one of these things. They were like hula hoops. They were all the rage. And there was something very American and very innocent about this, and yet the negative stories abound. And there's a tremendous urban mythology around Ouija boards that is frightening. I don't know why this would be, but I have never heard so many negative things about another divinatory art form.
No, you're absolutely right. And then the stories, Mitch, of how people have gotten rid of this stuff is incredible. Some
mm-hmm.
people will burn them,
yeah.
and they'll see ghostly figures rising from the flames.
Yeah.
It's really, really incredible stuff.
Yeah. There's an urban legend making its way around the internet that somebody burned a Ouija board and heard screams coming from the Ouija board. Now, I don't know whether that's true or not, but I really don't want to know. And you hear a lot of stories like that. Later in our conversation, we'll talk about the American mystic Edgar Cayce, but I'll just mention this as an aside in connection with Ouija boards. Edgar's son, Hugh Lynn Cayce, who was a lovely man, wrote a book called Venture Inward, and in this book he tells stories of people who contacted him who had trouble with Ouija boards, and the stories are blood-curdling. They involve, you know, housewives who started playing around with Ouija boards, and suddenly they felt that they were being assaulted by these malevolent figures who they couldn't get out of their house. And I look at Hugh Lynn Cayce as he's passed on now, but he was a lovely man and a highly responsible figure, and I think that he wouldn't repeat these kinds of stories lightly.
No. And so the question is it the board that creates the portal for these evil entities to come through? Or is it the person, by the mere fact that they're starting to do this, maybe they open up this portal somehow, just with their thought process? The board probably is nothing. It's the individual.
I think you're right. I think it is the individual. And look, Ouija boards at one time were so widespread in this country that it may have been that people who were in states of depression or in states of anxiety or who were suffering in one form or another turn to these things in mass number because they were so they just proliferated. They appeared in so many homes, and so it may have been that people who were suffering in one way or another got their hands on these things and call it the power of suggestion, call it unfortunate coincidence, whatever the case may have been. A lot of unhappy episodes seem to have followed.
You know, my mother is listening to this show in Detroit. Every time she hears the word witches or witchcraft, I'm sure she says another prayer. She's listening now, probably cringing. And,
well, so, saying a prayer never hurts, you know. But I think, well, first of all, I'm glad your mother is listening. She's up very late at night, and that shows that
she loves the program, supports it all the way.
Wonderful. Wonderful. I'm preparing a cassette for my mother, who goes to bed early. But
now, what would your mom say about your, I don't want to say your endorsement of the occult, because you really don't think it's bad, but you tend to I don't know. I would say you tend to favor occult type things more than most. Is that correct?
Yes, I think that's right.
Well, what would your mom say?
Well, she's always been very supportive. She has always supported. Ours was a household where you could always find books in every room. And there was always a willingness to approach all kinds of different subject matter, provided you did it intelligently. And when I mean intelligently, you don't go out and buy a car from somebody who you've never met. You don't go out and buy a used car that you've never test driven. You have to bring skepticism and critical thinking to these things. My feeling is virtually nothing is off limits in terms of inquiry, provided that inquiry is done intelligently. Do it with people you know. Go slowly. Don't abandon common sense. Use critical thinking. Be skeptical. You know, I don't like to talk in terms of open-minded because everybody thinks they're open-minded. You'll never meet a soul who doesn't identify him or herself as open-minded. So it's not about being open-minded, but it's about being critical. And when you're critical and when you use good sense, you can approach all kinds of subject matter and learn things and not go off the deep edge.
How did you then get kind of pushed into this field? How did this happen for you?
Well, there were many different ways, I suppose, but if I had to identify a couple of significant ones, I read a book by a very lovely man named Ernest Holmes called The Science of Mind. It's basically a book about positive thinking. Ernest Holmes was a metaphysical and religious thinker who went a little bit deeper down the rabbit hole than someone like Norman Vincent Peale. But when I read Holmes's book, The Science of Mind, I came to believe that there was a mystical dimension to everyday life, that our thoughts did have some degree of control over our life circumstances. And it began to suggest to me that there were ideas and information in the world that we live in that I hadn't learned about in school. There were other instances in which I encountered what might be called occult systems like tarot or astrology, and I found that they revealed to me things about my character that were more penetrating in some cases and more personal than things I could have admitted to myself. And when I began to discover these things, I started to think there is a current of information in this world that goes beyond the traditional scholastic subjects that we grow up with. And that's where my inquiry began.
And it continued to grow and grow and grow, which has led you into the career you're in now.
It continued to grow and grow. I came into contact with groups of like-minded people. I came into contact with different ideas, different thinkers, some of which I discarded. There were things that I took a look at. You know, we were just talking about Ouija boards as one example, and I thought, you know what, this is not really a place to go. There are other ideas that I have not gotten into yet. You don't take everything. You sort of sift through and you see what seems to resonate, what seems to be verifiable in terms of your own experience. There's a metaphysical thinker named Neville Goddard, who was a wonderful man who died in the year 1970, and he was also a purveyor of positive thought, basically. And I took a very strong interest in his writings over the last couple of years. And in fact, in the month of June, there's a book coming out that I'm introducing called The Neville Reader. He wrote under the solitary pen name Neville. And he's a metaphysician whose thought made practical sense to me. Again, it's of the positive thinking variety, but it goes off in many different directions. So you sample different things. You see what works for you, and you be critical.
The Neville Reader.
The Neville Reader, coming out in the month of June.
How do you find it?
It is available right now on Amazon.com, where you can pre-order it. You can probably pre-order it through just about any bookseller. The publisher is DeVores & Company. They have their own website, which is DeVores, DeVores.com.
You know, I've noticed that people are fascinated by this kind of subject matter, not only in the radio show, obviously, but also in the books as well. People sometimes look for positive techniques just to help themselves.
Mm-hmm.
As you dabbled into the practices of the occult, did you ever stumble across voodoo? Because I talked to an old guy from Haiti.
Yes.
About a year ago, and he says voodoo's not bad at all. It was never the intent that Hollywood has made it out to be.
I couldn't agree more. I have not had direct contact with voodoo in terms of its core source. But there is a practice which comes from the Caribbean and goes on in this country called Santeria, which is in some respects a mixture of Catholicism and voodoo traditions, and it's practiced with great passion and for the most part with good intent. Here in New York City where I live, you can walk into many corner stores and you can buy candles and other supplies that are related to Santeria. And many of the people who practice it regard themselves as good Catholics, and they are in fact good Catholics. But they have imported into the tradition some of the voodoo practices from the Caribbean. And I have not had direct contact with voodoo, but I think it's another one of these things that has been given a bad rap by Hollywood and by certain institutional religions. It's a very beautiful tradition with deep roots.
Well, he told me that the sticking of the pin, I said this a few weeks ago, you know, we would think, my God, what kind of a cruel thing is this? He said that in the original voodoo practice, every person who practiced voodoo was given a doll that represented them, so they would pin his name on the doll. So
yes,
we'd know that it was, you know, it was Mitch's or George's. And
yes,
Hollywood took it and said, you stick a pin in somebody, you want them to die of a heart attack or something like that.
Yes, yes. Something that you'll find in most occult traditions is the idea that you should never wish something upon another person that you wouldn't want visited upon yourself, that nature has a way of swinging whatever you put out there directly back towards you. And this is something that's recognized in most of the traditions. And you could call it by different names. You can call it karma. You can call it love thy neighbor. You can call it the golden rule. But it exists in all religions, it exists in all cultures, and it exists in all practices. And that is, I think, the core tenet of all occult practice. There is a saying in Wicca, if it harm none, do what you will.
Hey, you're up on Freemasonry too, aren't you?
Yes, sir.
Let's talk about that when we come back along with Edgar Cayce, okay?
Sure.
Our guest, Mitch Horowitz. I'm George Norrie. We'll be back in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM.
The official website of Coast to Coast AM is www.coasttocoastam.com. Log on now.